freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
Jay Buhner just punched me in the kidney.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
Well, we're going to excuse you from the interview.
Doesn't really work that way, Sherm. This is a show that has my name on it.
It kind of does, though.
Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen in Ballard.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
Oh, hello!
Yes, here we go on a Friday. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com. And the Seattle Sports application. Don't forget all the podcast platforms out there. Formal Friday. Everybody got their formal wear on today?
You call this formal wear?
For you? It is your formal uniform. Yes.
Sure, yeah, why not?
Yeah. You think we should start wearing tuxes to work more often? Do you think that would kind of beef up the reputation of the show?
Well, you saw the trip that we did.
Tails, maybe. Tuxes and tails.
You saw the trip that my friends and I just took to Nashville. We all wore yellow suits.
Yeah. No, I don't think we should do that.
Out.
No, you look like mustard.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Pretty much exactly what it was.
Maura, what do you think? Should we start wearing tuxes to work, Justin and me?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I think it'd be a good big ruffled shirt, tux.
I was going to say like Step Brothers, but you don't like those movies, so.
What are you talking about?
You don't like any Will Ferrell movies.
I think Step Brothers is okay.
Oh, good.
Yeah. That's funny.
It's a step in the right direction.
No, I like some Will Ferrell movies. I just think that the stupid racing one is dumb.
Talladega Nights.
God, is that a bad movie?
Shake and Bake.
I didn't like it the first time I watched it.
Well, I didn't get to a second time. So maybe if I watched it again, there'd be something there for me. But the first time was enough. I was pretty much
the same way with Anchorman. I didn't think it was funny the first time I watched it.
Yeah, I think Anchorman's good. That's a funny movie. All right. Anyway, I try to be honest with you guys. I try. Right. I think transparency is important. I think honesty is important. That's why I don't mind admitting things like that more. That's why I take all of these bullets, all of these arrows, all of these shots to my reputation based on movies that I think are terrible that the rest of the world thinks are genius.
That's why
I'm willing to be honest with you guys. I'm willing to be transparent. I'll tell you about the issues, you know, that I've had snaking the hair out of the drain of my shower and the rust that accumulated thereafter, some of which I got out yesterday with a magic eraser, but not enough. It only came off the grout. I don't mind. I'm happy to be transparent. And so I absolutely admire it and enjoy it when other people are equally as transparent. I thought John Schneider was very much that yesterday when he was on with Wyman and Bob. Great interview they did with John. And if you didn't hear any of that, go download it. It's at seattlesports.com. But I think, look, we'll get into Gino and what he said there. But before you delve into all of what's important from a moving forward perspective, I thought it was really interesting and, again, transparent and honest to hear him talk about how they felt last year and what a validating season this was.
Yeah, I agree with you. A huge success in what we all would have considered a transition season. We knew where we were, right? We knew we went through and, you know, having to release Bobby as a cap casualty guy and then trading, you know, Russell Wilson. I mean, you're talking about two of the best players ever played for this franchise. And so, you know, look, the whole organization, and I'm proud of everybody, you know, Dave Pierce and his staff, like everybody. I mean, we put the walls up and we hunkered down. We took a lot of crud all summer.
Right. They heard it. They didn't say anything, as he said. They hunkered down. They put up the walls. Dave Pearson is sort of their head of PR, if you don't know who Dave is. And they took a lot of crud, according to John Schneider. He heard it. We know Pete heard it, right? Pete talked about it being validating earlier this year after beating Russ in game one. And, you know, he didn't want to go there again at the end of the year, but certainly he didn't mind at the beginning of the season. So it's good to hear John say that there was, you know, an understanding that what they were doing was risky and that not everybody agreed with it.
You guys know we took it. Now I have pictures. I have pictures of my favorite breakfast place. You know, I have pictures of it. You know, fire John and Pete. You know, Bobby and Russ are the heartbeat and soul of this football team. And I got my picture taken with it the day after the draft, and then. I don't know, about a month ago, we were headed out there on a Saturday morning, and they took the sign down, so I just took a picture about it.
That's awesome.
I knew there were people upset, but who's putting signs up?
Especially signs that say, fire Pete and John.
Well, they knew he would be going to.
Right. Well, they might not have known. I mean, John, you know.
His favorite play. They had to have
known. You don't think John moves in darkness and in secret?
Under the cover of night.
Yeah. I don't know. That's pretty great. That's very John, though, to have taken a picture with
wearing,
it.
Like the Point Break president's mask.
Exactly. He's got like the Richard Nixon mask. He's like, I don't know who this is. Just some guy who happens to like your pancakes. No big deal. They heard it. They saw it. They felt it. They know not just what local folks were saying as you know, signs at his breakfast spot. But you think John goes to like an IHOP, gets a little like Rudy Tooty, fresh and fruity, something like that?
I don't know. It sounds like everything that I've heard about him, none of that should be surprising.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you'll see him at Denny's getting a Moons Over My Hammy or something like that. He heard it not only locally from fans and people who own restaurants, but nationally, right? And all of the grief that they took and the power rankings and the, you know, the belief, I think, more than anything, that there was a huge group out there who thought Jody Allen should have chosen Russell Wilson over them. Right? And it's not just Pete, because John took a lot of bullets, too, for the drafts over the course of the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Fairly, I think. I mean, I think some of it was justified. They've really struggled with a lot of their drafts. They haven't had the kind of class that they just did since, 2012?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, there have only been a couple of decent classes since then. So kudos to John. He heard it. Some stuff must have changed in order to do so. They probably drafted, and he said it yesterday, a little bit more for just talent as opposed to need, because they were in a little bit different mode this offseason. And it seemed to set them free a little bit to go be them again. That's what Pete alluded to that last year or last offseason. Back in their wheelhouse, exactly. And I think a lot of people thought that meant Pete. Right? Because he was working with younger players and free from Russ and able to kind of do a lot of the things he wanted to do competition wise. But let's not sleep on the effect that that may have had on John Schneider as well, who gets back into his wheelhouse instead of trying to, you know, pick apart and pick these extra little pieces that you need to fit around one person or a couple of people. John's just in the talent evaluation business, right? Who's good? Who works? Who can we find a use for? Who's a good football player? And, you know, he even says some of it is their talents, and some of it is finding the right personalities that you want to be the nucleus of your football team.
You know, interviewing Ken Walker, I mean, you know, this guy's a dog. You know, that guy, Abe Lucas, he's a dog. These guys are, you can tell, like, these guys, you know, it's not going to be too big for them when you're speaking to them. And when you're evaluating the people that are interviewing them, so, you know, if I'm interviewing Clint Hurt, Matt Berry, Aaron Heinlein, I know how those guys are going to be asking questions and then how those guys, the players respond to them. So, yeah, really interesting. It's a, you know, the combine's changed a ton. You know, the height, weight, speed part, I mean, we have all these GPS numbers now that we get from the schools, too. So you can literally see how guys are running, what their pads are, instead of, you know, just training for a 40.
GPS. Isn't that amazing? They get GPS numbers from the school showing you just how fast the guys are in pads, et cetera. It's pretty darn cool. In any event, kudos to John. I hope that he feels like he can take a bow. I hope there's an element of legitimizing and everything
validation,
over the last couple of years. I don't know whether he'll win executive of the year. He should have won it in 2013 and probably 2012, but didn't either year. One of those years they gave it to the guy who drafted Andrew Luck. Like, that was some genius move. Hey, I got the number one pick in the draft. Who do you want to take? Andrew Luck, executive of the year. Unbelievable job, buddy. Really, really impressive. Like, what?
To be fair, didn't they go from winning like one game the year before to making the playoffs?
With Dan Orlovsky and like Kelly Collins. Right, Curtis Painter.
They turn more around than just the quarterback.
Not much more.
I think he deserves it this year. I'll be pretty mad if he doesn't get it this year.
Not much more. Dude drafted Andrew Luck with the number one overall pick, and they're like, whoa. Can you believe what this guy did in Indy this year? They had Curtis Painter and Dan Orlovsky, and now they have Andrew Luck. Executive of the year. Unbelievable. What a job.
Crown this man.
Schneider probably deserves it again this year. I don't know if he'll win it or not, but I'll certainly be rooting for him. All right. I'm excited to get to Need to Know, mostly because I want to talk about what happened last night. What a hockey game we all witnessed here at Climate Pledge Arena. That and more next. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com.
need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Well, now that the Seahawks season is over, the focus shifts from Pete Carroll to John Schneider. And the Seahawks GM spoke yesterday to Wyman and Bob. First order of business, obviously, what do you do with Geno Smith? And I think he made the Seahawks' intentions pretty clear.
First and foremost, we want Geno to come back. I mean, there's no question, right? There's a balance when you're building a team, always. And Geno knows that. I mean, he's been to a number of different teams, and he's seen it firsthand. So he understands the process. We've had clear communication with his agency and Geno himself, so he knows where we stand.
He knows where we stand. The deal's not done yet, right? And he knows sort of what it takes to build a team. So, Bob, with a very good follow-up.
Do you go into those discussions already having that number in mind?
Yeah, but Bob, that's in any negotiation, right? I mean, there's a drop dead number, sure, absolutely. No, we're not going to go there, right? And you know, that's. You know, it sounds cold, but like any negotiation I've ever been, you know, it's like, okay, that's not happening.
I think John does a nice job of explaining that it's not personal, right? I mean, it's, you have to have a philosophy. You have to have an ability to negotiate. And if you don't have that drop dead number, it's hard to have any leverage and it's hard to get what you want done. So the question is, where is that number for the Seahawks? Is it in the 30s, as we've heard, you know, some folks talk about with a franchise tag as a base? Is it in the 20s where they're going to need Geno to, you know, probably leave some money on the table even after the season he just had? That obviously is where this negotiation gets a whole lot more interesting. So really good interview. And if you have the opportunity, go find that at seattlesports.com.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Well, deal for the Mariners yesterday as they sign another veteran left-handed bat. That would be 33-year-old Tommy La Stella, who was with San Francisco last year and played mostly as a DH. With that name, yes, he is from New Jersey. It's true. His numbers have been down the last couple of years, but he does hit right-handed pitching reasonably well, comes very cheap, having been released by the Giants, despite them owing him another $11.5 million this year. So, projects to be about a league-average bat, but he does give them a little bit of insurance at first base and DH from the left side. Now, a little easy to get frustrated with this offseason and small moves like the La Stella one, and I'll admit, it's not that I don't like Tommy La Stella, but the difference between him and Brandon Belt I see is fairly significant, and I still would have preferred them to go down a road like that. But I'm also going to try to remember that they did make their biggest move in July. In fact, they made the biggest move in the league in July when they acquired Luis Castillo, who they'll now get an entire season out of. Here's Jerry DePoto with us yesterday.
It's huge. And we talked about it last summer when we acquired him. You know, we were maybe irrationally high on what we thought Luis Castillo could deliver for us. And then he delivered it, and particularly delivered it once we got into the postseason. We think that the Rock is an ace, that this is what they look like. It's all the weapons. He attacks the strike zone. He's got a presence, and it stands up when you're facing the best lineups in short series, which is, you know, another big thing.
Did he say we think that the Rock is an ace?
Yeah, just said out loud. I was like, what?
Is he calling Luis Castillo the Rock?
It's kind of rad if he
is. I kind of hope he is. I didn't hear that when he said it yesterday. I must have missed that somehow, but it sounds like he's calling Luis Castillo the Rock, and that the Rock is an ace. I'm 100% on board for that, and I'm excited about having Luis Castillo for a full season.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Oh, what a game. What a game last night for the Kraken, who did give up a pair of leads, but they finally got it done in OT.
Delays again. Burakovsky with a shot. He scores!
Yes, they certainly do. Burakovsky gets the credit, his second overtime winner this year, but doesn't get there without a really nice night from Ryan Donato. Had a couple of goals, a few other chances, had an assist as well. Just really has played well since being elevated to the second line with Jaden Schwartz out. Brandon Tanev had a goal as well. They dispatch with the Devils, who came in having won five straight. Kraken now tied for first place in their division. How about that? They've got 27 wins, which matches their total from last year. We still have 37 games to play. So hopefully they can win one out of their next 37 and have the best season in franchise history. What do you think? We'll give it a shot starting tomorrow night as Andrei Burakovsky's old team, the defending champion Colorado Avalanche, are in town. Also this weekend, you may have heard, division round of the NFL playoffs. Everybody know who they're rooting for in all these games? I'll run through it for you. Jags and Chiefs are first, 1:30 Saturday. I sometimes root for chaos, but I think I want the Chiefs in. I want to set up a great AFC Championship game, and either matchup with the Chiefs is a great AFC Championship game, so I'll be rooting for Kansas City. Giants-Eagles, 5:15 Saturday. Eagles, Jalen Hurts. That'll be my rooting interest. I like him. I think he seems like a really good dude, and he's fun to watch.
That one, you're not okay with the chaos of Giants winning that one?
No. Not really.
Okay.
Bengals, Bills. Justin, who are you rooting for? Bengals,
yeah,
Bills.
I'm jury, so I got to keep thinking on that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I'm with Jalen Waddle or Eric Waddle.
Weddle?
Eric Weddle.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you'd still be with Eric Waddle.
I just screwed up both of his names.
Yeah. Yeah, that one's a tough one for me to figure out who to root for. I'm not sure.
I'm with Jalen Waddle, too. I just want you to know.
Oh, okay. Him is all, that's him as well.
We'll play that sound coming up in a bit.
His touchdown dance is a penguin
I do like that, yeah, the way he waddles around. I'm going to go with the Bills, just because of the DeMar Hamlin thing. Sorry, Justin. And then Cowboys-Niners, no pick. How about that? I refuse to root.
I'm the same way on that game.
Should be fun to watch, though.
It's like, I like Dak Prescott so much. I just don't like Mike McCarthy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Or the star on the helmet, I think, is really
sure.
a challenge.
Or Jerry. Yeah.
Are you going to root for Brock Purdy?
I can't do that either.
I might.
Can root for the story.
I don't know.
Root for chaos surrounding the Cowboys kicker again.
Yeah, I think that's
there
good.
There we go.
More movement across the NFL yesterday. Vikings fired defensive coordinator Ed Donatell, who, if you remember, the Seahawks tried to hire last year. Bucks fired Byron Leftwich. Excuse me. And the Ravens fire offense coordinator Greg Roman. There you go. That's everything you need to know. They say that Lamar Jackson's going to help choose the next offense coordinator. The guy's not even under contract, but they're 200% sure that he's going to be back next year. So.
I know. I like the idea of him picking the offensive coordinator and then being like, you guys are really going to like him.
Yeah.
I'm out.
See
you later.
Yeah, I'm gone. Yeah, no, I won't be there. Enjoy dinner. I'm going to be at a restaurant, but hey, cooked for you guys, true. Left you food in the oven. I will be out at 13 coins if you need me, mm-hmm. but for everybody else who's going to be here, the food's in the fridge ready to go. All right. If you heard any or missed any of Jerry DePoto yesterday, we got it coming up for you. There are some really exciting young players in the Mariners system. I know there's been sort of an idea that because of the deals they've made here in the last couple of years, last year really, to acquire some of the talent, that all of a sudden this farm system is bereft. It's not. There's still some really high-end talent, not just in it, but on the way. And Jerry talked about that and a whole lot more. It's next. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com.
The Jerry DePoto Show, presented by Seattle Pump and Equipment on Seattle Sports Station.
Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning.
How are we doing?
Outstanding. How about yourself?
We're good. You ready to, like, head to Arizona? Like you know, ditch the
rain?
I was
ready yesterday.
Oh, you were there yesterday?
No, I was ready yesterday.
Oh, you were ready.
I'll be prepared as soon as the time comes.
Gosh, when are you going? Soon? Do you leave like a few weeks early? Like, you know, I really got to get down there. I got to, you know, make sure that the fields look good and, you know, kind of do a little, reconnaissance ahead of time.
Do you follow behind the pizza oven that you have shipped there
right.
for your place down there?
We just pull it on a U-Haul. But in all honesty, usually right around, you know, arbitration exchange day, which was last Friday for us, is usually the time when I really start getting the itch to start spring training. And, you know, it becomes pretty real at that point. And we typically leave about a week ahead of the opening of camp. And as I mentioned before, you know, over the years, we tend to drive down and take our time getting there. But this year's a little earlier because of the WBC and, you know, we're checking in right about the same time, but we'll get to, you know, position players and full squad maybe a little sooner than we typically do.
I know you had a French bulldog and a bulldog, right? Where are you at right now, dog wise?
We lost a Frenchie late last summer and we have two English bulldogs. So they keep us busy.
You feel like you upgraded to a larger size?
I don't know if I upgraded to a larger size. We've got one that's maybe, he's sizable and out of control. And then we have maybe the daintiest English bulldog that's ever been born. But, they're fun to be around.
I don't know how I transition from bulldogs to arbitration, but I'll do my best.
Yes.
You said last week was kind of the start of the itch as arbitration began. How did that unfold for you?
The dogs or the arbitration?
The arbitration.
Yeah, the arbitration. We had six arbitration eligible players, and we were able to reach settlement with three of them. And three others, we'll go through the process and head to ARP hearings with Teoscar Hernandez and Dylan Moore and Diego Castillo, which is just part of the business. And I think the players understand it. We understand it. Nobody loves it, but it's part of what we do. And in the end, I think everybody walks away happy.
Does that mean now that you have to go through the process, or can you guys still agree to something?
We could agree to something. We adopt the file and go type mentality, which is, we negotiate up until a certain hour, which for us happened last Friday afternoon. And if we're not able to reach a settlement by that point, we'll just go to a hearing unless there is an opportunity to work out a multi-year agreement in there. And, if you don't have some type of guidelines, many teams in the league, behave similarly, and not all, but many teams in the league behave similarly. And it's just a way of effectively setting boundaries on when you'll negotiate it and when it's probably best to call in a third party to make a decision.
Hey, what do you think of computer projections for players, for teams, et cetera? We're looking at the Zips projections, which came out yesterday, and there's Steamer and all these other sort of computer generated projections. Do you guys look at those? Do you have your own? Do you care much about or value the opinion of what the computers project?
Really value it, particularly the projection system that Fangraphs uses, which I think is among the most sophisticated in what's available on the internet. But with we do our own. We do value it highly, like 29 other teams. We're building a team, and we're building it in anticipation of what the returns might be. And fairly or unfairly, we'll look at those Zips projections. It's funny, if you look back, a year ago, roughly a year ago today, when our Zips projections came out for the 2022 season, we've effectively upgraded it at eight of the positions on the field, and including the bullpen year over year. And this year, the improvement was pretty significant, and mostly in line with the way we projected. We're off on a couple of guys, some guys we see, more potential or upside in for this season than the systems do. And like I've mentioned to you before, those systems need major league performance to project major league performance. And, we tend to use something that's a little more, it's geared toward the player and some of the traits that player embodies, whether it's physical stuff, it's power, it's swing decisions and some of the things we've talked about through the years. So we tend to rely on our stuff a little more, but I think the Fangraphs product is about as good as it gets in what's available to the public.
I think baseball and Bill James back in the day has always been on the cutting edge of this when it comes to information. Obviously have reams and reams and reams of data as well with so many games played. But as you can imagine, Jerry, doing what Salk and I do every day and talking about all the different sports, and now we're kind of talking and have talked obviously a ton about the Seahawks and the value and the Geno Smith value and what these numbers can't measure and what they don't see. I'm just kind of curious, over the years, as you've worked with these both in-house and studied them outside, what can these algorithms not measure? What is most difficult outside of, as you said, major league projections? What are some of the other areas that are most challenging from your perspective with these algorithms and this data to try to project moving forward?
This is pretty easy for me, and it's not even particularly abstract. There are things you can measure and things that you just have to see and experience. And one of those is experience. And you know, you will over time, as you introduce players into your clubhouse environment, you identify leadership abilities. You identify how that player melds into your community, work ethic, you know, what kind of character they have. And we don't really have an algorithm, and I'm not sure we ever will, to be able to identify those things. And there's a baseball IQ that is really hard to pinpoint, but you know when you're looking at it. And, you know, when you're around players that have very high baseball IQ, they just know where to be and when to be there. It's, you know, I'll borrow from hockey, you know, Wayne Gretzky in the 80s used to always talk about skating to where the puck will be, not to where the puck is. And that's built in. That's an instinct that players have that we just don't have an algorithm that can identify. And it's important and something that we hold highly valuable.
I would imagine that's got to be even more challenging to try to predict when you're talking about 16 or 17 year old kids, which you're doing in that international free agent class. And you just kind of wrapped up that portion of your off season. And I want to make sure I'm getting the kid's name right. Is it Felnin Celestin? How do you pronounce the kid's name?
Felnin Celestin.
All right. Felnin Celestin. Got it.
Who is among the best international prospects in recent memory. And depending on, you know, which grading system you follow, he's among this year's top group. I think there's a pretty fair consensus that his upside potential is about as good or better than anybody in this class. And it stands out among the shortstops in recent memory. So, you know, Felmin's a switch hitter. He's a five tool guy. We've been watching him play and have built a relationship with him, similar to what we've talked about with Julio back through the years. Only with Felmin, it started at an even younger age, where, you know, our first contact with him, it's now been, you know, multiple years, and he's just 17 this year. So, you know, he's an exciting young player. He can run, he can throw, he can really defend at shortstop. He's got power. He can hit to all fields. And he's grown substantially even since we first laid eyes on him. So there's no telling what the upside could be. And, you know, we think we're fortunate to grab him. And Frankie Thon and our international scouting people continue to do a phenomenal job in just pushing talent into our system. And like we've seen with so many of the young players that have come through our Dominican Academy, it's a pushing good people, you know, good kids into our system that we can really help grow and finish their, you know, their formative years are going to be spent in Boca Chica with our coaches and our teachers and under our guidance. And we take that responsibility, you know, pretty serious.
How quickly do you set them up with Julio?
Very quickly. and, you know, as it goes, because Felmin is from the Dominican Republic and, you know, Julio, obviously from the Dominican Republic, we have many of our DR players tend to cycle through our academy during their off seasons, even after they've reached the big leagues, just to visit, to get a day hitting in the cage and, you know, or something like that. Right now, Julio is in Tampa, but minimally, you know, Felmin, and this is a little different than really any other international player we've signed since I've been here with the Mariners. Felmin is going to come directly to Arizona, and he'll join our mini camp in February with our top minor league players. And that will be the first time that I'm sure that he spends significant time around Julio, who will obviously be there for the big league camp.
I know this is all normal for you, but as you were kind of rattling the numbers off with Felmin, and a five-tool guy, he's a switch hitter, he does all this, and he's 17. And the fact that this started not at 17 or 16, but you rewind it back to, I mean, when was the first time your guys put eyes on him? 14, 15 years of age, Jerry?
Yeah, I think we first saw Felmin play in a youth tournament as a 14-year-old. And then had, which is, you know, typically in the international market, like we see now, and, you know, I'll point toward Little League or travel ball clubs. You know, internationally, you know, there are some countries, many of the Latin countries especially, who do have built out Little League programs. Some don't. And, you know, you're left to scout these players, you know, through viewings with the trainers who train them. And it's many of these players, you know, Felmin among them, and Julio, you know, back in the day, they work with these trainers starting at very young ages, some as early as 12 or 13 years old, who, you know, will move into a trainer's academy. And just like we, you know, rear our players at the academy in Boca Chica starting at age 16 and 17, you know, they are helping these kids grow as baseball players and trying to give them the tools to, you know, to survive. And depending on the training facility or the trainer, you know, we have a group or groups that we tend to really trust and believe in what they do with their players. And we tend to go back to that shop, you know, and it, for instance, Julio and Noel de Marte and multiple others that we have signed through the years all came from, you know, the same group. And you know, we trust what they're getting along the way. And Valentin is going to join our system, and he's further along the most in the exposures that he's had.
It dawns on me as we're talking to Jerry DePoto here on Seattle Sports on 710. We were talking about those projections and, you know, seeing Luis Castillo at a, you know, projected 4.8 wins above replacement sitting atop your rotation when this year begins. What does it mean to have that, to have an ace, to have Luis Castillo set and ready to go to start your season?
It's huge. And we talked about it last summer when we acquired him. You know, we were maybe irrationally high on what we thought Luis Castillo could deliver for us. And then he delivered it, and particularly delivered it once we got into the postseason. We think that the Rock is an ace, that this is what they look like. It's all the weapons. He attacks the strike zone. He's got a presence, and it stands up when you're facing the best lineups in short series, which is, you know, another big thing. And when I look at those projections, when you see Luis sitting at the top of it, you know, the thing that appeals to me most is, you know, a year ago this time, we had six starters listed on the Zips projections, only one of them above 1.8. And this year we look at those projections and we only have one below 2.6, which is a pretty exciting thing. And to have that kind of depth and impact with legit ace value at the top and feeling like we could then run out our next three starters who can pitch alongside just about anybody in the league. And also feeling like, and this is not being critical of the system, I said it takes time. I feel like the guy who's on the low end of that is George Kirby, who we think has considerably more now upside. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have to wait 3 years for George to reach his ceiling. We saw it last year, what he's capable of.
So what do you do? I mean, you know, looking at this now, you've got six guys in your rotation that are major league starters. You've mentioned to us that Miller may be ready to go right off the bat. And, you know, Zips, we were talking to Dan Szymborski yesterday who created that. And he said their computer actually even likes Miller more than some of the guys that are in your rotation now for this year. Can you go with a six-man rotation? Can you go, you know, are you willing to put all of those guys out there at once?
We could, you know, but like we did last year when, you know, after we acquired Luis, when Flex went to the bullpen, that there's so much value in having, you know, multi-inning depth, someone who can pick up those long innings, especially when you're limited to 13 pitchers on a roster. So, you know, we want to be open to that. We do feel like, you know, between the six guys on our, you know, in our major league rotation mix right now and the group that comes after it, this is as deep as we have ever been. And I've been doing this for a number of years now, and it's as deep as any team I've ever had in terms of starting pitching. And I say that, and I know we're still going to be in a situation in June or July where we're biting our fingernails thinking, are we going to have enough innings tomorrow? But this is why you build, and our system has really developed to the point where, you know, it's not only Logan and George and what they're able to contribute to our rotation, but guys like Bryce Miller and Taylor Dollard and a group of six or eight that are lined up right in back of our big league group that we think are very capable as well.
It feels like in a lot of sports, Jerry, conventional wisdom has been flipped on its head a little bit. Basketball has become more positionless, and I'm just kind of curious if from a rotation standpoint, one of the things that Dan said to us yesterday is really the Mariners have three number twos. You have an ace in Ray and Kirby and Gilbert, really three number twos. Do teams around the league still pin guys at he's a one, he's a two, he's a three, he's a four, he's a back end of the rotation? Does that still exist in your guys' realms today?
You know, we do. And I think that's it's part and parcel for the league we operate in. And, you know, where we started the conversation, at least this part of it, when talking about an ace, you know, there's, you know, for years, we've talked in my lifetime, we've talked about the true aces and the difference that they make. And the reason why you tend to do that is you're lining up your pitchers based on what your anticipation or expectation is in a postseason short series. And you know, the advantage that you have when you have, you know, the kind of impact and depth that we have is it's real. And I can vividly recall, and it wasn't too long ago, like sometime early last year, when, you know, the pundits may have looked at our rotation and they saw, you know, five number fours and now we've got a legit ace and three number twos. So, you know, things change. And, you know, with the exception of Luis Castillo, I think that's the faces haven't changed. Just their, you know, the way people perceive them has based on, you know, things that we have seen since the day they entered our organization and expectations that we had of their growth. It's now real, and they are, you know, they've done it on a big stage. They've done it in a postseason, and you've seen the physical stuff. And, you know, George Kirby's not just a consistent strike thrower. He's a consistent strike thrower who's throwing 97 miles an hour with wicked secondary stuff. That's different. And I think, you know, the same could be said about Logan Gilbert or, you know, fill in the blank and hopefully the next layer as well. So it's an exciting time for us pitching
wise. Well, and bullpen wise as well. I mean, this bullpen should be stacked. And again, the projection systems really like your bullpen as well. Do you expect the roles in that pen to remain, I'll use the word non-traditional, just because there's not one closer who comes in for the ninth inning every time and one guy for the eighth? Do you expect that to continue?
You know, I kind of do. And, you know, like Brock said about the, you know, the NBA maybe not being positionless at this point, bullpens, at least our bullpen for the last few years, while it's been at its best, you know, we tend to just bucket our pitchers up based on the leverage and where you are in a lineup. And, you know, right now we go into the season and we have multiple pitchers who we trust in, you know, in our high leverage bucket. And now it's just a matter of determining what is the best matchup, you know, for the Mariners, not necessarily, you know, for that pitcher, because whether it's Paul Sewald or Andres Munoz or Matt Brash, we trust all those guys against any part of a lineup. It's trying to set them up to make sure that the other guy is in a premium position as well. And, you know, it's a fun bullpen. We got a lot of stuff. I know last week or even the week before, since we've acquired a couple of really interesting bullpen arms, this is what we do. We grab the JD Bukauskases, we grab the Justin Topas, and not all of it's going to work, but we've had a fair amount of success converting those players, their natural skills, into something, you know, impactful in our bullpen. And credit to Trent Blank and to Pete Woodworth and Max Wiener and our pitching group. They do a phenomenal job with that. And maybe we're a little overconfident in believing that they can continue to do that. But, you know, as long as we can go out and acquire pitchers who have the physical abilities that these guys do, we do feel, you know, pretty certain that if we acquire enough of them, we're going to be able to build an impact bullpen and do it in ways that maybe seem, you know, non-traditional, but they're becoming more traditional with each passing year, not just because of the Mariners.
As I'm thinking about spring training, last thing for me here, I'm thinking about being down there and how there's always like one guy that everybody wants to get a little glimpse of that we haven't seen yet. Like, oh, you got to go see Matt Brash's slider, or you got to go see, what was the kid a few years ago from, he came in and pitched an inning or two for you guys and then went to Chicago, who just threw, you know, a million.
Oh, yeah.
Thiago Vieira, is that his name?
Thiago Vieira.
Yes.
Yeah, Thiago Vieira.
And I just remember just watching him in spring training. It's like, whoa, you just got to get a look at this guy. Do you have a young player in your system, whether it's a pitcher or a hitter, that we just have to go take a look at just to see the raw skills or the raw tools or something that he'll show at spring training?
Well, you know, the one that will jump off the page simply because of what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation is if you get a chance to go to the backfields during the mini camp and watch Felneen, it's pretty special what he's able to do at his age. And you know, that truly stands out. But in the big league camp, and those who we're anticipating 73 players in big league camp. Wow. We'll be near double digits or maybe even double digits in players leaving us for the WBC. But, you know, the guy that really stuns you, if you have, you know, 3 days to go sit on the backfield and watch the physical ability on the field, is Harry Ford. And now, when you see Harry, he is about as athletic looking a catcher as you're ever going to come across. It's like he is incredibly detailed in how he takes care of his body and disciplined and how he eats. So it stands out immediately how athletic he looks, especially for a catcher. And he's not a tall, you know, person, but he gets on the field and the tools play big. He just starts hammering balls and you're going to see the six or eight homers in a row, and they're not all to the pull side. He'll hit them to the big part of the field and oppo. And then you watch him execute his at bats, and it's so disciplined. You know, he's a very advanced player for his age, which I think is why, you know, up to and including in, I guess, the recent Baseball America top 100, where we were fortunate. We landed three guys again. And Harry was the highest of that group. And they actually projected him forward as our third baseman after Gino departs. And because of that athleticism, it's certainly not because he can't catch. He can throw. He's a good receiver. He does all these things well. But like Bryce Harper, you see the athlete and the impact with the bat, and your natural inclination is move him and get him there quicker. But he is the guy that really does stand out.
So like a modern day Benji Molina is what you're saying, or Sal Fasano?
No. Yes, something like that.
Okay,
something
just checking. Like hey, Jerry, thank you. It's good to just be talking baseball on a gray, you know, raining, god-awful, springish winter day here. Just terrible. So thank you. It's nice to start thinking about the future, thinking about warm weather, and thinking about spring training. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, guys.
All right, there is Jerry DePoto, and I got a text here from 360 that says Luis Castillo's nickname is Justin La Piedra, which translates to The Rock.
Ah, makes a lot of sense.
So great, that's kind of awesome. So they call him The Rock.
Now that I read that, I have heard that before. I just didn't put it together.
I like him even more now.
That's great.
And I was already pretty well in love with Luis Castillo.
I don't think there's room for you to like.
Well, it just went up another notch. I'm 100% all in on Luis Castillo. All right,
for him.
Coming up next, do the Seahawks have leverage, and if so, should they always use it? It's coming up. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710, and the Seattle Sports application.